The McDiarmid Institute in Wellington has been recognised for the fourth time as a centre of research excellence, received $48 million in funding. The Institute was founded in 2002 by Victoria University's Professor Sir Paul Callaghan. It brings people together from across seven institutions in New Zealand, five universities, Callaghan Innovation and GNS Science, to use science and nanotechnology to address things like climate change, disease and pollution. The funding, which will be spread across 7 years, will go towards the work the Institute is doing on capturing carbon and turning it into fuel, also creating technology that will lower the amount of carbon computing using the internet, streaming television, creates carbon emissions created. Our co-director, Professor Justin Hodgkiss from Victoria University of Wellington, is with us now. Good morning.
Kia ora, Catherine.
First, how significant is this recognition and funding on this kind of a stable footing?
Oh, it's very significant. We're absolutely delighted to have the opportunity to tackle these problems that are so important for New Zealand. We've got nearly 8 years to have a crack at these problems and really set New Zealand up for a prosperous zero carbon economy heading towards 2050.
It's the bane, isn't it, of research and researchers, is this constantly having to go back cap in hand with long-term projects and short-term funding. This is giving you some security around what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Kind of 7 or 8 years, it doesn't really get any better than that. And what it means is that we can be bold, we can be ambitious, and we can bring a big team of together to tackle problems that wouldn't otherwise be tackled in the science system with short-term projects.
So how do you go about the work that you're doing? Are you given a certain brief, and from that you target particularly promising initiatives? Give us a bit of an overview.
Yeah, well, what we did is came together as an institute a couple of years ago and really kind of thought and dreamed about the type of work that we wanted to do. And we're a material science institute. That means we bring together chemists, physicists, engineers, biologists who develop materials to create new properties. And we found increasingly that we were working on things like batteries and solar and even electronics. But then when we come back to our values and we think, what matters most to us, and it's really things like mitigating climate change and sustainability. And so over the last couple of years, we've really coalesced around that idea of using material science to solve some of the biggest problems that we're facing in terms of sustainability. And the other side of that is that when we create technologies that will bring us a more sustainable future, we're not only delivering sustainability in New Zealand, we're actually creating export technologies and jobs for New Zealanders.
Are we seeing that happening? Are we getting from the research to startups to actual companies existing?
Yeah, we absolutely are. So the McDiarmid Institute, when Sir Paul Callaghan founded the Institute in 2002, that was his vision. He was the first of our researchers to start a company, Magritech, back in 2004. And since then, there's been about 19 other spin-out companies, most of them actually in the last 3 or 4 years. So it's really taking off. And even outside of the companies that our own researchers have started, there's this whole vibrant ecosystem of tech spin-out companies in New Zealand. The high-tech sector is growing at 10-11% year on year, and even without COVID, it's poised to become our number one export within a few years, ahead of dairy, ahead of tourism. And these are low carbon, low environmental footprint industries, and even companies and industries that have a really positive effect on our environment. So to give you one or two examples, and these are the first one, Mint Innovation, is not a company that was started by the McDiarmid Institute, but many of our graduates now work there. And Mint Innovation, they take e-waste, so that's old computers and things like that. They crush them up and they put it through a process to extract gold and other precious metals. And so they call it urban mining. And what they're doing is saving things from going to the landfill and recovering value from it. Another company along those lines has just started from our research, our investigators, and that's called Zincovery. They won the Callaghan Innovation C Prize this year. And they're taking waste from the galvanizing industry, which would normally cost money to get rid of, and then they recover zinc back from that waste. So they're recovering something of value from a waste stream that would otherwise cost a lot of money to get rid of. So these are examples of things that have popped up in the last 5 years that really are a win-win in terms of environmental and economic impact.
We spoke to Mint recently. We did, Mint Innovation, what they're doing. So sometimes it might be a researcher starting a business, but other times it's actually just linking very closely.
Linking closely, and the key thing that we deliver as an institute funded by the Tertiary Education Commission is, you know, we're all about developing people. So the key thing that we deliver to industry is using those connections to deliver capable people, so industry leaders, people with PhDs who can actually lead research programs in industry. Because New Zealand governments, successive governments, have always had a challenge of increasing business R&D in New Zealand. R&D expenditure on research, on innovation, and that requires people.
So what percentage of graduates, say, will go on to be researchers and to stay in an academic or a research field, and what percentage of graduates are actually going into some kind of industry or public sector science role?
The vast majority of them are going into industry roles, if you public sector. Very few of them are actually staying in academia, and that's something that we know right from the start, that we're not training people to replace ourselves as academics at universities. What New Zealand really needs is people to be leading scientists in industry. So we've actually surveyed graduates from the McDiarmid Institute. These are PhD level graduates in the last 5 years. Around 70% of them are in technical roles in mostly in industry in New Zealand.
And what are their specialties? You're a professor of chemistry, correct?
That's right.
So within the institute, what are the specialties within that specialty?
Yeah, so within material science, we have chemists like myself, and even then there's chemists who make things, chemists who kind of measure properties of things. We've got physicists, we've got biologists who work with proteins and enzymes. We've got some engineers who kind of put things all together and optimise their function. We've now got experts in Māori, Mātauranga Māori research, and bringing that knowledge into sustainable materials. So it's very broad, and we really leverage that breadth.
And is that kind of alignment of the scientific disciplines, has it been relatively rare in recent decades? Have we tended to segment people in our institutions?
I think it was always the goal of the McDiarmid Institute and other centres of research excellence back in the early 2000s to break down those silos and bring people together into more interdisciplinary directions. And I think that that's been a great success, that, you know, I see people around New Zealand working in biology, engineering, physics, as much as my colleagues now as I do the chemist in the office next door to me.
Well, let's look at some of the specifics, because we have this challenge, this big challenge, now legislated for, plus our pledges at Paris. And at the moment, things aren't tracking too well on New Zealand's carbon emissions. I think the Ministry for the Environment doesn't see them even peaking until 2025, and we're missing targets. So, again, without wanting to hurt the economy or hurt the well-being of people, we're looking for game changes in a way in how we are living and producing. What are some of the specific projects of real interest here? The carbon capture conversion into fuel work is about what?
Yeah, so that's about using porous materials that are kind of like molecular sponges that selectively soak up CO2. And then once you've got a hold of the CO2 in a sponge, then you can apply all sorts of chemistry to change it into other things. So you might want to change it back into a fuel and thereby close the carbon cycle. So that would be carbon neutral, because you would be using it over and over again. And carbon is just happens to be kind of a useful carrier of energy, if you like, but we just want to make sure that we're capturing the CO2. But we might be capturing that CO2, converting it into something that is not then used as a fuel. So that would be negative emissions. So that would be capturing carbon, you know, use it to make something to build houses with or something like that, so it just stays in the solid state.
So using it as like a building material, literally a building material.
Exactly,
right.
Yeah.
So how are we capturing the carbon in the first place, with the CO2 emission in the first place? It's gone, it's in the atmosphere. We've now got 200 years worth of it in the atmosphere, right? So the sponge sits where, is how big, and does what? Let's get that basic.
Yeah, okay. So if we get down into a really small scale, the sponge is kind of crystals that have pores that are the size of molecules. But then that needs to be embedded in a membrane. So something that you could actually hold with your hand. Now, the easiest and most effective way to capture carbon would be from emission sources where there's a high concentration of CO2. And so that might be in, you know, factories, processing plants and things like that. And you would have this cartridge with membranes in it, and then you might either take the CO2 somewhere else to do the chemistry or do it directly there. In the longer term, you know, it would be great to have, and there's kind of prototypes imagined where you would have these kind of fans that just are constantly sucking CO2 out of the air and then converting them to other things.
So how far are we from concept to reality or even to prototype?
Taking it out of the air, I think it's, you know, proof of concept, yes, but in terms of scale, I think that's a long way off. So, but I think it's going to start in ways where there's really a good use case. So, you know, maybe in, you know, another example might be regulating CO2 levels and, you know, greenhouses and things like that as a kind of a practice case before getting to really large-scale CO2 removal.
What is the typical length of time, and don't say a piece of string, or the trajectory that you go through from these imaginings, really, of new innovations to prototype, and then ultimately the big challenge, as you say, is scaling up, making something cost-effective, all that kind of thing? Like, if you can't put a time limit on it, can you put a sort of a mathematical trajectory on it?
Yeah, I mean, people talk in terms of technology readiness level, TRL, and there's a kind of criteria that you rank things, and we are mostly, so TRL 10 would be like really ready for market, but we are mostly working at things at the other end of the spectrum, kind of 1-2, and that's because the big ambitious things like that would not otherwise happen. So back to your question, you know, for things like the CO2 capture really for large scale, you know, you're probably looking at least a decade before it's really having that impact at scale. But there's other forms of impact that it would have along the way.
To the other, the computational one, this is the computer one, this is big. We know now, I'm trying to put a figure on it, too scared to say it out loud, I've got it in the back of my brain, on what percentage of global CO2 emissions now are from computer use and some of the, you know, the big kind of farms that are running now, server farms, etc. We know how much they've taken over our lives and they're carrying a big level of emissions. Do you know how significant that is now?
Well, what I know is that's the carbon cost of that. So that's the electricity to do all of the computing, but not just to do the computing, but to cool down these data server farms. So the carbon cost, even pre-COVID, had exceeded the carbon cost of air travel, global air travel.
So this is different from emissions per se. This is saying this much energy use goes into it. With associated
emissions.
So you can say that through the life cycle of this enterprise, the emission that we're talking carbon emissions, and it's higher now than air travel.
Even pre-COVID, it was higher than air travel, and even worse than that, everything related to kind of computer technology tends to grow exponentially. So it really is becoming a massive problem, and it's the problem has quite fundamental sources because it takes flow of current through silicon to do computing, and that generates heat as electrons flow through, and that's why they need to be cooled down. And you know, our thirst for actual processing power has gone up enormously.
So what is this project attempting to do?
So what we're attempting to do is totally rethink the architecture of computing materials. Instead of being silicon that, you know, processes switches and zeros and ones, binary logic, we're trying to create materials that will think more like a brain. So your brain is actually has a power of about 20 watts. So it's like a dim light bulb. I should use that with respect to my brain, dim light bulb. But it's not much power to actually do some really complicated things and recognize people, recognize faces and things like that. It's not that great at just crunching numbers, but certainly at pattern recognition, it's really good for such a low power. And so but it doesn't think in zeros and ones. It's kind of random, and so we're working on random networks of nanomaterials and things like that will think more like a brain in these kind of random spatiotemporal.
I'm curious if this is what you're saying. What it does is it does no more than it has to do. Like, its potential for energy use, its potential for effort is enormous, but we just skid along doing as little as possible, right? Because we get tired. Is that kind of what you're trying to design?
Well, kind of, but it's you know, the brain isn't kind of working, firing electrons through transistors. It's just these little fluctuations, these correlated fluctuations. Mm. And so it's been shown now, including from people in the McDiarmid Institute, that you can just have a random collection of nanoparticles that are centrally like your neurons and they're connected to each other. And it has many of the same properties. And so we want to expand that idea further. And it's not just to save energy, it's to increase computational power for doing things like artificial intelligence that's more about pattern recognition.
Thank you, Justin. And I'm pleased for all the scientists that there's this kind of security. And what happens for the other centres of excellence, that research excellence? Do they all have to go through this process and prove their creds? And
there was a selection round that's been prolonged a bit, but there's now 10 centres of research excellence funded, and we all got the news a couple of weeks ago. So they have exciting times ahead, and that's spanning a wide range of research areas that are important to New Zealand.
Thank you. Justin Hodgkiss is co-director. He's Professor Justin Hodgkiss, co-director of the McDiarmid Institute and Professor of Chemistry also.